This officially marks the end of summer. Hope everybody had a great summer. We have a very active fall. There have been some questions before we start on this morning's forum. There have been some questions about the debates that we are holding in partnership with McNeil Lehrer Productions. The first debate is going to be here in Charlottesville on September 18th, which is Tuesday, 2 weeks from now. It's going to be at the Rotunda. As all of you know, the Rotunda is very small and has very limited seating. And so we've had to restrict that to a small group that the fire marshal will let us cram in there. We have also, however, arranged to have all of Newcomb Hall Ballroom, which is huge, serve with Jumbotron televisions. And so anyone in the community who would like to go is more than welcome to watch it there. It will be webcast live, and it will be shown. It's being fed by PBS on September 28th. Now, we don't know when local stations will choose to run it, but it will be sometime either late September or early October. As I mentioned, it will be shown on the live webcast, and of course will be on our site. The News Hour with Jim Lehrer will run highlights the night following the debate. In other words, on the 19th, they will be showing highlights, including interviews with students who are watching and others who are participating. So I hope very much that you'll participate in that one way or another. It's an exciting new initiative for the Miller Center, and one that we hope will contribute materially to bringing civil discourse back to the public arena. Well, let me welcome you to the Miller Center Forum, the first event of the 2007 fall season. We are delighted to have as our guest Chuck Todd. Chuck Todd is the political director of NBC News since March of 2007. He consults with and appears regularly on the Today Show, on the Evening News with Brian Williams, on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, as well as the MSNBC and CNBC program lineup. Before moving over to NBC, for the better part of 15 years, he was editor-in-chief of the national journal's The Hotline. Chuck Todd teaches a course in political communications at Johns Hopkins University, and he is a graduate of George Washington University. Please welcome Chuck Todd.
Let me make one quick bio correction, and I just always do this because in the media everybody wants honesty. I'm actually not technically a graduate of GW. That's okay. We'll get into reasons on that at another point. But I always want to correct the record. You know, public blogs these days, right? You always got to be careful. Want to be completely open and honest. So hopefully that's a good way of starting off with where we're headed. This job, I've been on it exactly 6 months, and it feels like 6 years. It's the pace of this campaign has been unbelievable. I think about sort of the way what happened in 92, which was the first cycle that I started covering politics, and sort of what happened in 96 and 2000, and this one, of course, is unlike any other. And there's a number of reasons for that. Some of it, of course, is technology. A lot of it has to do with the current occupant in the White House, and I think that the intensity of this campaign is almost driven as much by President Bush than anything else. The hard part about doing these things, by the way, now that I'm at NBC, back before I was when I was at National Journal, is that one of my standard things I would talk about is sort of how the media would do various things. Well, the media will dictate this, and the media will determine that. You know, the media will create a two-way race. The media can't cover three-way races. The media can't do this. And now, you know, I said that the first couple of months after I took this job, and somebody reminded me, well, you know, you're part of the problem now, or you're part of the process. So, You know, now it's sort of like, well, the candidate's got to do these things, and the candidate's got to do this. So, because the media is not as powerful as I thought it was. New York City, that's a whole other story. But let me. One thing I want to start out, I like to start out sort of at 30,000 feet. I know a lot of you probably want to immediately get into the presidential race and talk about the horse race. And you were talking about you wanted a civil, try to contribute to raising up the civil discourse, so I guess I shouldn't start on the Larry Craig story, right? You know, it's not exactly a way to be uplifting about things. You know, I have a very wide stance about some ways I'd like to discuss that story, but no, in all seriousness, it is, I just want to talk about that for a couple of seconds. I think it is interesting that Craig is wanting to fight this now and sort of unresign, because I think he's angry at how little support he got inside the Senate Republican caucus. And if you notice at how quickly, and I think there's sort of a lesson here, sort of, if you notice how quickly that the Senate Republicans decided to have civil, what I call it civil war surgery, right, which is just cut off the leg, you know, get rid of the gangrene, and here you go, soldier, here's the gun back, keep fighting, is showing the almost the air of desperation that's going inside the Republican Party now. They just fear any of this stuff. And it was like, well, he pled guilty. Okay, get him out. Just hurry up. Sweep the problem under the rug. Don't let this become a Mark Foley situation. You know, sort of they learned the Mark Foley lesson too well, right? And they just immediately reacted and immediately tried to get rid of the problem. And I think Craig's sitting there going, you know what? Say what you want. You know, and he's probably got his own personal demons maybe he's fighting or his family issues, and I don't want to get into that. Some of this could be generational and how he's handling this or what he's got to deal with, but at the end of the day, he's probably wondering, where are my friends? I've served in the United States Senate for 17 years. Where are my friends? And he's angry, and he's thinking, you know, why do I owe them any favors? Look what they're doing to me. They're trashing me. So I think that's what's going on here a little bit, and I imagine at some point he might just decide, you know, when I am going to walk away, I don't want my personal life people psychoanalyzing me on the cable news networks over the next 3 months, which was the original warning that Mitch McConnell and those folks gave to him, which is basically saying, look, you're better off to get out now because you don't want to be cable television fodder for the next 2 or 3 months through a Senate ethics investigation. I mean, you know the way they are in the media, right? And how they'll treat a story like that. So I assume this will end up resolving itself where he ends up at least saying, look, I'm not going to resign, but I'm not running for re-election. I think the nightmare scenario for the Republicans is if Craig ends up on the ballot, because then it would make it an issue. It actually could put that Idaho Senate seat in play, which is an issue in of itself, a problem. The way things are set up now, I mean, it is almost mathematically impossible for Republicans to get back control of Congress without some sort of seismic national landscape shift, because they're just not getting anybody to run. And if they have more and more problems defending their own seats or more John Warners deciding to retire, they are not going to they're not going to have any chance at all even to set themselves up to win back control of the Senate in 2010. But I'm getting too far ahead of myself, because there is this other election here we want to discuss a little bit. So I assume the Craig stuff will sort itself out in the next couple of days, but it certainly is an interesting sideshow. And if no help to the Republican Party. That said, you know, that's this week. In the next couple of weeks, I think that the rest of this month and possibly this calendar year is going to be all about Iraq. And it will somehow dominate, probably have to dominate the presidential election, at least this month it will, when General Petraeus comes in and delivers his report. And you will have this fight about withdrawing troops. And you already have, I think what's been interesting is watching now the Republican candidates start talking about troop withdrawal. Mitt Romney, over the last 2 days, has called Iraq a mess. And he has talked about, oh, there will be significant, substantial troop reductions by 2008. I don't know if he's willing this, hoping that if he's the nominee, that's the case. But I think it shows you where, you know, and part of this is, you know, a John Warner, you know, who sort of is saying, hey, we got to get 5,000 troops out of there by the end of the year, that he is providing the cover that a lot of the Republicans were looking for to start showing some distance with the president. Meanwhile, of course, the president, by going to Iraq, sort of trying to shift the focus away from the central government and the problems that the central government in Iraq has had to what's happening on the ground, you know, trying to do an old Tip O'Neill saying, you know, all Iraqi politics is local. See, it's all getting good there. Pay no attention to this Maliki in the behind the curtain. So we'll see who's going to win that spin war. I mean, that's what it's become. And it will sort of dominate, I think, the presidential race over the next couple of weeks. But I think what's interesting about Iraq is that while it will be the defining issue, particularly in the Democratic primary, over the next 3 or 4 months, I'm starting to wonder if it's going to be the defining issue in the rest of 2008. I'm looking at this credit crunch and this mortgage crisis, and particularly the individual states that are being affected the most, mainly the Midwest, usually the battleground of this country, and, oh, by the way, Florida and the condo market that's down there. When you start looking at particular states that are being affected being affected the most by this current housing bubble bursting and the whole credit thing, the economy could end up being a bigger problem for the Republican Party in 2008 than Iraq. They may long for the days of Iraq being the central issue if the economy ends up being the number one issue, because in general, when an economy is perceived to be bad, automatically swing voters, middle-class voters think, oh, the Democrats will have government help bail us out, so get the Democrats in there. So automatically, there's sort of that automatic, you know, sort of in the way that in pre-Iraq, I think that, you know, national security is an automatic gut check. People assume a Republican is a little bit better in national security than a Democrat. You have that same feeling, I think, when there's sort of domestic problems, automatically there's that knee-jerk assumption that a Democrat is going to be better to help get government involved than a Republican. So if this credit crunch becomes the number one issue, because if Mitt Romney's right, and I've talked to a lot of Republicans who assume that this is going to be the case, that there will be at least less than 100,000 troops by the Republican convention, so that the perception will be we are drawing down from Iraq by Labor Day, by 1 year from now, Labor Day 2008. Well, then that will have at least turned the page in the heads of the voters that, okay, you know, that's an issue that's kind of in the rearview mirror. It's attached to Bush, and as Bush goes, that goes. What about the future issues, right? And most presidential elections are supposed to be about the future. And if that's the case and we start shifting toward the economy, that could end up becoming actually a bigger problem for the Republican Party to deal with, because right now they argue on the numbers, and you look at the numbers, and there's this huge disconnect, and we've been seeing in our own polling for quite some time, this disconnect between what the numbers say and the economy. Grow, you know, it isn't bad, they're certainly not near a recession, and then how people feel about the economy. The perception of the economy is that we're in a recession, or that we're going to be in a recession in less than a year. The numbers don't show that. And I think part of this perception, I think voters, between the healthcare, rising costs of healthcare, between long-term care issues, I mean, everybody in this room, I know I deal with, we all have a story about, you know, long-term care, retirement woes, money issues, you know, who's going to pay for what, you know, what happens next. And so that angst of bills that are not yet, that could be coming, is what's making people feel like the economy isn't doing well. Then throw in these stories every night on our air and others about foreclosures and about people losing their investments and stuff like this. And yet at the same time, the stock market's going up, right? I mean, there's this odd disconnect in sort of the numbers and what people are feeling. And we learned that in the 92 election. The numbers of the economy were actually improving in the fall of 92. But that isn't what the voters were feeling yet. And, you know, perception always trumps reality on that stuff. So, I mean, if the perception is this economy is getting weak and could be getting weaker, and the angst, whether it's globalization and the fear of, you know, what is the next great job creation that this country is going to be involved in, to how are we going to pay for health care, what happens now that we're all living, you know, that people born now are going to be living over 100, you know, how do we pay for that? When do we retire? All that stuff, that combined angst is going to make people perceive the economy as weak. And so I guess the one thing I would just caution is that don't assume Iraq is going, you know, what Iraq was the 06 election may not be the case for 08. That at some point Iraq may be not off the table, but sort of an equal issue with concerns about the economy. And again, the economy, a very broad circle of what the economy is now, from healthcare to globalization issues and things like that. All right, so there's my big picture spiel to make myself feel like I'm being smart about this and being high-minded and civil. So let's get into the Democratic. Let's get into the two primary races. I'll start with the Republicans because, you know, that's the meat and potatoes, the dessert I'll leave for that those other two candidates that everybody wants to talk about, including us. This week's interesting because the final piece of the puzzle is coming together with Fred Thompson on the Republican side. He's finally getting in, to me, feeding into the stereotype that he is nothing but a paper candidate, very scripted, right? He's putting, tonight there's a Republican debate, and I apologize, I know some people will be seeing this after the fact, but there's a Republican debate tonight. He's not participating. Every other candidate is. But he's bought a TV ad, and he will have a TV ad during the debate saying, go to my website tomorrow and watch my announcement. You know, and he's going to be announcing via webcast. Again, scripted event, not in front of any public. Also tonight, he'll be on Jay Leno. So while his competitors will have just finished debating on Fox News Channel, he will be on Leno at 11:35, basically pulling an Arnold Schwarzenegger and saying, tomorrow I'm announcing that I'm running for president. Then he does this whole series. So it's a very scripted, very Hollywood-style production. And it feeds into some of the negative stereotypes that are already building on Thompson. You know, is he just a candidate on paper, but he's, you know, is he a paper tiger? Is there any there with him? Is he just an idea? Is he a guy right out of central casting? We'll see. I think the window for him is very small. He has got, because he's got to catch up and build an organization so fast, because he's had such a sluggish start trying to get off the ground, he just, I don't know how closely some of you have been following, but literally every 3 days he has lost a member of his staff who have just quit over strategic differences, including today he had a new member leave this morning. So it has been, he has had a hard time getting started. A lot of people have tried to gravitate to him, and part of it is there was a vacuum left by George Allen, right? George Allen, 2 years ago, was thought that he was going to be the what I would call the conventional conservative candidate, the Southern. There's been, you know, there's sort of this idea that, you know, the South is the base of the Republican Party. There should be a Southerner conservative who ends up being one of the main contenders for the nomination. Well, that was almost preordained by us folks in the Beltway to be George Allen. Well, something happened on the way to that prediction, and all of a sudden we may have Vice President Webb. There might be a Virginian on the ticket, and it may not be Mark Warner or George Allen. I mean, I think that's what's kind of funny is 2005, who would have thought that the next Virginian on a presidential ticket will be a guy named Webb. So there's been this vacuum. And Romney's tried to fill it, trying to be this, you know, and he's had some, hasn't had a lot of success. McCain himself tried to fill it a little bit. He didn't have a lot of success doing that. Neither Sam Brownback or Mike Huckabee, who's sort of been buried in the second tier, seem to rise up and show themselves to be first-tier material. I think Huckabee had a shot at this, frankly, but he just didn't, he doesn't have the organization to make him take advantage of what he has in some great sort of talent. I mean, I think oratorically, he's probably the best Republican speaker the circuit. He's a former preacher man turned politician. You know, there's no better politician than a former preacher man, right? I mean, you know, they're just good at it. I mean, Huckabee's very Bill Clinton-esque in his ability to just be comfortable with an audience, any audience, and he's very good at that. But his organization has just been very poor, terrible, and so he's never been able to take advantage of that. So there's been this vacuum, and then so somebody came up with the idea of Fred Thompson, and a lot of us inside the Beltway laughed because we all knew Fred Thompson's reputation. This was a guy, you know, who he really always seemed to sort of get handed every opportunity, and he was always sort of the guy in the right place at the right time, you know, whether it was the Watergate hearings, you know, because he happened to be the driver for Howard Baker, I think, in one of his Senate runs in Tennessee, and ended up, you know, as counsel and all of a sudden the Watergate hearings, and he was one of the prosecutors to a very corrupt governor. There was a governor in Tennessee selling pardons, literally, and the entire Democratic state legislature passed laws quickly to figure out how to get the Republican, the newly elected Republican governor, into office faster to sort of get this corrupt Democratic governor out of office from selling these pardons. Anyway, the whole Thompson's movie career started because they were making a movie out of this guy selling these pardons, and the guy making the movie couldn't find somebody to play Fred Thompson. Well, who better to play Fred Thompson, right? then Fred Thompson. So, you know, and so it began, and literally this guy who made this movie ended up making No Way Out, a couple other, and then, you know, of course, his career was born. Then the Senate seat, you know, he talks about that Senate seat that he won in 94. Well, you know, this guy always had very lucky timing, right? 94, if he decides to run, turns out to be this great Republican tsunami, and he rides along. And, you know, he's a very, obviously, he's very camera-ready candidate, very television-ready. But frankly, not as television-ready as Reagan, and not as practiced as a campaigner through the ups and downs of this thing as Reagan. And I think that eventually that could be his downfall. That said, a lot of people gravitating to him. There is an opening for him. He's got about 3 or 4 weeks to make this happen, though. It's a small window, and it's not fair. But I think he'll be held to a higher standard because the Giuliani campaign, the Romney campaign, excuse me, in a lesser extent, the McCain campaign, all of a sudden going, hey, we've been in this thing for 6 months. If he's not ready to hit the ground running, that's his problem. You know, we're ready to go at 100 miles an hour, and if he's not, and then this whole idea if he's lazy will come in. I mean, he can't take days off on the trail very often. Any sign, I mean, he's going to be under a microscope. That said, if he performs, I mean, he could be the front runner by the end of the month, and it wouldn't surprise me. He could be out of the race before John McCain, and it wouldn't surprise me. You know, I think it's that sort of high risk. I've been comparing him to the Wesley Clark campaign. Remember all the anticipation of Wesley Clark. And on the first day that he got in, he couldn't answer the question of whether he would voted yes or no on the Iraq War resolution. And literally the campaign was a disaster from there on out. And then he decided to skip Iowa and all these things. And literally he went from a guy who went from, you know, zero to tied for the lead in the national polls in September of 2003 to, you know, sort of an asterisk in the presidential race by the time all said and done. So Thompson could end up this way. You know, he's you know, these late start candidacies, it isn't the way it works anymore. I wish it did. I wish we had conventions that mattered. I wish we had primary processes that lasted for 9 months after the voting started, not before the voting started. So, you know, there's a lot of things I wish worked this way anymore. It's hard to imagine, and if it does. And I think that the guy that's the focus right now to me is not going to be Thompson, but it's going to be Giuliani. To me, the Thompson candidacy is Giuliani's last test. Okay, the whole reason why there seems to be some hesitancy, Giuliani's sort of this, you know, is the front runner on the Republican side, but there's a hesitancy about him, right? You know, is he, you know, can a pro-choice Republican get the nomination? Is he a little too anti-gun? Is he a little too pro-gay rights? You know, how is he going to fit in? And, you know, at the end of the day, is 9/11 enough? And slowly but surely, he seems to be crushing these stereotypes that somehow he will fall apart. Part of it, he's been helped by the fact that none of his opponents have attacked him. In fact, today seems to be the first time I see any opponent that has questioned his credentials. John McCain, who's actually been he and Rudy are very close personally. McCain hit him today questioning whether his 9/11 leadership really means that he has foreign policy experience. It's actually something I've been wondering why others haven't brought up on him before, but it's the first time he's sort of taken any kind of arrow. Instead, it's been Mitt Romney that's been taking all the arrows, and all of the candidates have been piling on Romney at these debates. The second-tier candidates, they hit Romney. They haven't attacked Giuliani. It's like they're all fighting. They're all sort of acknowledging the fact Rudy's going to be in the finals, and they're just trying to be the anti-Rudy and seeing if they're the last man standing with Rudy. At the end of the day, conservatives will pick the guy who's a little more conservative rather than the guy who can win. And I don't think Republicans are going to be that way. I think Republicans fear losing, and I think they're going to vote on electability. And as long as Rudy continues to not lose his temper, if the old Rudy, the stereotype Rudy that all the New York City press corps seems to be waiting to happen, as long as his relationship with his children just get a little bit better. I don't think they have to spend Christmas together, but they at least talk on the phone once a week, you know. And if Rudy continues, you know, he's done something interesting. Whenever he's asked about his personal life, I think a lot of the campaigns, I know the Romney campaign is almost all but admitted to this. I said, why haven't you taken many shots at Giuliani? And he said, well, we assumed the press would do it. They just assumed that the press would end up burying Rudy at the end of the day, that the tabloids, the Daily News or the Post, you know, the way they can get with the screamers, you know, that at the end of the day they thought the press would take Rudy down. Well, it hadn't happened. And you know, Rudy has not ever lost. And he's got this great answer when he's asked about, remember at this one debate he was asked, they were all asked to name their most, you know, one mistake, you know, a mistake that they had made. And he said, I only have 30 seconds to talk about all the mistakes I made. What was interesting is he was saying, look, you know I've got a lot of baggage. I'm telling you I've got a lot of baggage, but I'm not going to talk about it. And it reminded me of how George W. Bush handled all those rumors about you know, what he might have done with drug use and his personal history with drinking and this or that, when he would just blanketly say, hey, you know what, when I was young and irresponsible, I was young and irresponsible. So what did he do? He owned up to everything out there without owning up to a single thing. And that's what Giuliani's doing. He's owning up, yeah, yes, you've heard the stories. Maybe I started my relationship with my current wife while I was married with somebody. You know, maybe all that stuff is true, but he's not owning up to a specific detail so that the press can go to that detail and suddenly make it, you know, some sort of big deal story, arguing over the details of what he said about when his relationship started with Judith Nathan, now Giuliani. Instead, it's sort of like, yeah, he acknowledges that his personal life isn't one to set an example for everybody else, but he's not going to talk about it. If he can somehow keep winging it like that, I think he's going to end up the nominee. I mean, I think that he is a stronger frontrunner than people realize. And then he's going to have something else that benefits him, and it's Hillary Clinton, right? At the end of the day, Republican caucus goers in Iowa, New Hampshire Republicans, and Republicans in South Carolina, when they're voting in this primary calendar, whenever the Iowa caucuses are, they might be tomorrow, by the way, so we'll see. By the time we're over, by the time people see this, it might already be over. But they're going to care about who's going to be the most competitive candidate. And, you know, as long as that's out there, as long as Giuliani can say, hey, if you elect me, I will make it a nightmare for the Democrats, regardless of whether it's Clinton or Obama or Edwards. I'll make it a nightmare for them because they'll have to, I can win Pennsylvania. I can win New Jersey. I might be able to win Connecticut. I'll certainly be popular in Florida. I could maybe make them spend money in California. And the thing is in these early states, Republican voters and Democratic, they're very calculating. They are thinking about these things. You know, normally people say electability is never, you know, an issue that people think about. Voters are much more aware of this stuff than ever before, particularly in these early states. I mean, they're all could be political pundits. You know, we can put any 10 Iowa voters on, and they do just as well as anybody else on a Meet the Press panel or a Hardball panel with Chris. So it's a very calculating electorate, and I think at the end of the day, that's going to benefit benefit Giuliani a lot. And then the other thing is, you know, the way the Romney campaign is working, he is trying to do it the old-fashioned way. Win in Iowa, that'll give him a lot of national attention, and then he gets to win New Hampshire, and then momentum will build, and Rudy won't be able to stop him. But he's got a big problem, and that is us in the media. Will we cover Mitt Romney's victory very well in Iowa or New Hampshire? Or will we decide that the winner of the Democratic caucuses between Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John Edwards will be on the cover of Time magazine and the cover of Newsweek and lead the nightly news? Look, the compelling race seems to be Clinton versus Obama, right? It is historical. It is interesting. The first woman president, maybe the first black president. There is just a million storylines that the media is gravitating to that. That will, in a weird way, help Giuliani because Romney will never get the attention he needs to get off the ground. We saw this happen in reverse in 1988. In 1988, Dick Gephardt was running a very conventional campaign trying to win Iowa and then from there do well in New Hampshire and all this stuff. The problem was the media covered the other race. It was more interesting. The vice president lost the Iowa caucuses. Oh, my God, that's fascinating. Pat Robertson, Bob Dole, there were all the interesting stories to tell were on the Republican side. And so that media boomlet that you normally get when there's two competitive primaries to cover, there's only so much airwave to go around. There's only so much internet, you know, both internets, right? According to the president, we have two internets. But both internets, you know, can't cover all this well. So at the end of the day, you just have this feeling that that Romney's going to have a hard time getting the conventional boost that you get out of Iowa and New Hampshire because there'll be so much more attention. 65% of my time will be talking about what it meant for Clinton to win or lose, what it meant for Obama to win or lose, or Edwards to win or lose, rather than, you know, Giuliani. If Giuliani just finishes second in Iowa, it'll be enough, and he'll sort of be able to plod along. So Giuliani is, I think, more of an entrenched frontrunner, frankly, than we in the media give him credit for, and I think he's got an easier time at his getting his nomination, frankly, than Hillary Clinton. So let me get to Hillary Clinton here, and then I know I'm starting to ramble here, and I apologize. I think the most fascinating thing about the Democratic primary is that it's not about Clinton in an odd way. It seems to be a referendum on whether Obama is ready. The entire Clinton campaign seems to be shaped around that, right? Her message When this thing started, Clinton assumed that she was going to be the interesting sort of first-time candidate. Oh, wow, could we really elect a woman president? That's not what anybody's talking about. Who gets the bigger crowds, Obama or Hillary? Obama, 2-1. The only time Hillary can get big crowds is when Bill's with her. The only time she has gotten 4,000 or 5,000 people to show up in Iowa for a big rally or New Hampshire, it's been with Bill. Obama gets it on his own. He's sort of the circus. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, he may not end up the nominee. You know, campaigns can be about one person and that person lose. I mean, look at the George Allen race. It was all about George Allen. So, you know, it's not always a good thing when the entire campaign is a referendum on whether, you know, you're fit for office or whatever. But that is what this Democratic campaign is really boiling down to. Is Obama ready? If a Democratic voter thinks he's ready, they seem to be more inclined to vote for him and ready to bail on the Clintons. If they don't, they seem to be more and more comfortable saying, okay, I can handle her as the nominee. I mean, I think when this campaign started, there was a lot of assumption, particularly by my bosses in New York City, since nobody in the Upper West Side seemed to like Hillary Clinton, that there's no way women are going to support Clinton. Well, that's just not true. Okay, now she does have this likability thing she has to deal with, and she's got to make people a little more comfortable with this idea that she's not going to be a polarizing figure, et cetera. And she has made a lot of progress on that front. But she still seems to be a candidate that Democrats are going to settle for. That there isn't going to be this excitement. It's sort of like, okay, you know what? This Obama kid's not ready. I may be more inclined to like Edwards' rhetoric, but at the end of the day, you know what? She is tested. She's not going to screw this up. She will competently plod along. You know, I've compared it to Big Ten football, although after Appalachian State, maybe that's not such a good thing. But I've said, you know, that she's Big Ten football. I grew up in Miami, so I'm a big University of Miami fan. Barack Obama's Southern football, right? It's a little flashier. Better chance for being able to put up 70 points on the board, you know, like we saw in the national title game last year, you know. But the Big Ten teams, they never make mistakes. They just plod along 3 yards in a cloud of dust. And they don't make mistakes. They wait for you to make mistakes. The question is, will Obama make enough mistakes to make sure she's that she just plods along? She doesn't make a lot of mistakes. And when she does, in the last couple of weeks, she's hit a few potholes. Nobody's noticed because of this guy named Larry Craig. You know, she's sort of benefited from that, but she really doesn't make too many mistakes. She's the most practiced candidate. She speaks, a colleague of mine timed this, her new stump speech. She was off, he timed it in New Hampshire, and then he timed it in Iowa. It was off by 7 seconds. She is so precise in her ability to sort of be on message and to just get it, and is that it's that perfect. And so she isn't going to make it. The question is Obama going to be seasoned enough by the time Iowa voters tune in? And that's another thing. It's like sort of when is this thing going to get decided? I think they have until Thanksgiving. Obama's got till Thanksgiving to close this gap and to make people think he can win. If people think he can win and do this, he's going to have to change people's minds by Thanksgiving. The way the holidays work, this calendar, it's going to be right after New Year's at Iowa. I mean, literally, people aren't going to, I don't think people are going to pay attention between Thanksgiving and New Year's. I think family will come first, maybe, right? You tell me. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe we'll all be tuned in. But I think it's going to be hard to change minds between Thanksgiving and New Year's when all of us have a whole bunch of other things to be working on. So I think in a weird way, we'll know in the next 2 months whether Obama's going to pull this off. You know, whether he gets a lead in Iowa, beats her at a couple of debates. This calendar is set up for him, not for her. She has tried everything to change this calendar because Iowa, this is a state that is one of only 5 to never send a woman to Congress or elect a woman to governor. This is a state that's going to be very hesitant. The Clintons have never really had a campaign in. Bill Clinton skipped it in 92. They don't have an entrenched organization. So she could easily lose Iowa. Obama's from right next door. Edwards obviously has been campaigning there since he decided to get into politics. New Hampshire, independent voters. Obama does much better with independent voters than Clinton. The folks that supported McCain in 2000, according to our analysis, seem to be leaning toward Obama. And in New Hampshire, independent voters can pick any ballot. That's an automatic advantage. And if he proves he can win, then suddenly you go to South Carolina, where there's a huge African-American population, which right now is being split about 50-50. But part of that is simply he's not that well-known yet in the African-American community. If he starts winning these things, that'll change. He could suddenly get 75-80% of the black vote, and he wins. So suddenly he could win three in a row, and then that changes the entire complexion. And the way the media is going to cover all things Clinton and Obama, it will, if he beats her three in a row, it's hard to recover from that. So this calendar is set up in a way that's very dangerous for her. At the same time, all she has to do is win one of the three. For Obama, he can't stop winning. If he ever shows a sign of weakness, she'll end up the nominee. Because I've gone through this in my head. I cannot picture her concession speech. I can't picture her quitting. Obama, you can picture him sort of saying, well, I gave it my best shot. There's always an... You know, this is it for her. This is her one shot at this thing. She'll never get out unless there is just no chance at the end of the day. So I will stop there. I'm sure there's a ton of questions. We can get deeper into, you know, psychoanalyze some of these folks, from Larry Craig to Rudy's past to Bill Clinton. But I will stop talking and let you guys dominate the conversation.
I will move to the back of the room, and those who have questions, and we certainly encourage questions. Chuck Todd and I talked for 30 minutes this morning, and he's already answered all my questions. And so I will encourage people to queue up in the back of the room, and we'll go through as many as we can. But while I'm walking to the back of the room, Chuck, I'd like to ask about the maturation and perhaps change in emphasis in the electorate. For the last several elections, family values and all that suggests has been sort of front and center. If family values were going to be the touchstone this year, John Edwards, with his very compelling family situation, the death of a child, the cancer of his wife, would certainly be the family values candidate, but he's not registering on the political Richter scales at this point. Giuliani, on the Republican side, he and his wife between them have, what, six marriages?
That's how much he believes in marriage. Yeah. He always believes in getting married. You know, the Mormon is the only one with one wife. You realize that.
And the Clintons have certainly had their marital problems, but the voters don't seem to be paying much attention to that, at least now. And if voters are less focused on family values, why is the Larry Craig story so big? Are voters just simply not paying as much attention to personal conduct, particularly family and sexual conduct, or is this still going to be an important issue?
Well, it's interesting. I think that the bigger that the election issues are, and boy, does it get any bigger, right? Doesn't this election feels like, for me, it's my generation 60, right? It's a generational switch. It's this next big thing, globalization, America's place in the world. I mean, you know, to me, the biggest issue for the next president to deal with is American exceptionalism. But you don't really talk about that. That's an intellectual discussion that you have here at universities. But sort of this idea, you know, what if America isn't number one anymore? Right? How is America going to deal with that? You know, is America ready to deal with that? So what I'm getting at is the bigger that the election feels, the less likely little wedge issues work. And so, when have we seen the little wedge issues work? When the elections have seemed small. 88 seems small, so it became sort of about the flag, right? Flag burning, isn't that why Dukakis lost? You know, some would argue. I mean, you know, little things. In 92, frankly, yes, it was the economy, but it seemed like a smaller election. So, you know, Ross Perot and you know, whether George Bush broke up his daughter's wedding was a big issue and things like that. In 2000, whether Al Gore sighed too much, you know, it just was a smaller election, peace and prosperity elections in particular, which both Moore 88 and 2000. So I don't think you're going to see those wedge issues this time. That said, I do think the Republican Party worries that one of the, you know, it's funny, the Republicans are in, there's about half the party's in denial about whether Iraq cost them 06 or whether it's their own hubris that cost them in 06. And there's a lot Karl Rove in particular, who believes that the reason Republicans lost control of Congress was not because of Iraq, but was because, you know, they weren't spending, Mark Foley, Jack Abramoff, the scandals. So there is this part of the Republican Party that feels, boy, you know, if we're going to be the party of family values, then we can't allow a Larry Craig to survive. We have to shove him out. We can't tolerate it. It has to just, you know, move on. And yet, of course, you look at him and you say, well, what about David Vitter? You know, that sort of first thing that came to my mind is, why did the Louisiana senator, who didn't quite own up to saying that he hired a prostitute but didn't deny it, sounds like a guilty plea to me. And a lot of people said, well, the whole reason why they've called for Craig to resign is because he pled guilty. And while there it isn't technically, and it was a misdemeanor, well, you know, frankly, all Vitter did was a misdemeanor as well. But it was basically admitting guilt. And nobody called for him, other than Sean Hannity, actually, of all people, nobody called for him to resign. That one actually surprised me. The first time, Hannity's usually a very talking point guy. It's the first time I'd seen him sort of break from the Republican talking point. You know, the cynic in me says, well, Idaho is a Republican governor, and Louisiana right now is a Democratic governor. So Louisiana would have appointed a Democratic senator, and Idaho will appoint a Republican senator. So one wonders if that had something to do with why it was easy to call for Craig's resignation, a little harder to call for Mr. Vitter's resignation. But no, I think in general, I do think these wedge issues are going to have less of an impact this time. I think it's why candidates with baggage are going to get, you know, one could argue that Clinton, Giuliani, for instance, could only win in this environment when the thought of, boy, you need somebody that can just sort of run something better. You know, Bush just seems to be incompetent. This guy in New York City, whether people may not have liked him, but he seemed like a competent guy, so they'll overlook the baggage because I think they think, well, you know, so I think in times of the bigger the election, the bigger the problem, the less focused other campaigns and we in the media will be on the little stuff.
I was wondering why the media isn't able to juggle more than one ball at once. When you say that you will be covering only the Democratic winners in the early primaries, and not the other candidates in the Republican side, why with 24 hours a day now, can't you at least talk about two different races?
Well. I'm not coughing because of the question. I swallowed down the room. Look, the easy answer is to tell you that, look, we will cover them both. The question is, what are we going to cover at 2 p.m. on MSNBC, and what are we going to cover at 6:30 at night on the NBC Nightly News? I mean, and that's, we only have 22 minutes on the NBC Nightly News. We only have 30 minutes on the Today Show before we get into the style section of the Today Show and weddings. I know there's 4 hours of the Today Show, but you know, we got to see what people are wearing tomorrow, right? Sorry, this is going out over the airways. I'm sorry, Mr. Zucker. I can't wait for the fourth hour, political fashion in the fourth hour of today. You know, I've been
this out too.
Yeah, I've been bragging. We're going to have 4.5 hours of broadcast. Yeah, no other network will have 4.5 hours of our news broadcast news programming, but. I guess what I'm saying is, when I say us, look, I think we will cover them both fairly evenly. I can tell you that more than likely the lead story is going to be Clinton versus Obama. That matters, that extra emphasis. I can tell you that Time and Newsweek will probably not have a split cover. We saw it in 88. What I'm saying is, yes, there are more outlets, and it's more likely that you will see that all of the media collectively can cover all of these things. But what will the emphasis be? And I'm just trying to be honest here and tell you, I know what the emphasis is going to be. It's going to be Clinton. I can tell by what I can sell my New York bosses on stories. I have an easier time selling anything Clinton versus Obama than I do Romney versus Giuliani. I think the Romney story is fascinating. I think the two most underreported stories of the last 6 months is the rise of Mitt Romney to unknown governor to with a 40% chance of the Republican nomination. And Rudy Giuliani, whose resiliency, all of us conventional wisdom smart Alex, said never would, no way, this guy won't even run. I think he's probably going to be the nominee. It's a stunning development when you think about it. And textbooks will, you know, history books will have to reanalyze and figure out how did this happen, particularly if Giuliani ends up president. I mean, can you imagine the long-term effects? And this is on both of Clinton and Giuliani as the nominees. The loser If Giuliani is the Republican nominee and loses the general, the Republican Party will have a purity fight like you've never seen. They will say, see, this is what happens when you compromise your principles on stuff like abortion, guns, and gay rights. This is what happens. The end of the day, and they'll come up with some statistic that found 2 million evangelicals decided to stay home. Which I'm sorry, I just don't buy. But the long-term effects of a Giuliani, if Giuliani wins, that will gets rid of the notion that a pro-choice Republican. All of a sudden, there'll be a whole slew of California Republicans who think they can run for president now. That it's, you know, New York Republicans and Florida Republicans, people that have had to be more moderate and get elected. And it could totally change the ideological framework. I mean, sort of the long-term implications of Giuliani's candidacy as far as the political landscape is concerned. And for me as a political junkie is fascinating. Now, I got a minute 45 on the NBC News with Brian Williams, so good luck with selling that story, of getting that on. I do think that, you know, that's why we have MSNBC.com. I mean, it's funny, this job, it's why I wanted to take this job now and I wouldn't have wanted it 4 years ago. Because now there is web outlets, there is places. I can still write. I get to write and I get to, you know, do on air. And you get a wide audience and at the same time look at a niche audience and still get into the weeds in this. With Clinton, I mean, this is a battle for control of the Democratic Party. What if the Clintons don't have control of the Democratic Party anymore? What happens to the Democrats when they kick their Clinton addiction? If she's, you know, either loses or is in either the primary or the general? I mean, you know, there will be a vacuum. Somebody's got to run the Democratic Party. Who will it be? I mean, you know, there's this huge... So the long-term implications for both parties of Clinton and Giuliani are, to me, just fascinating. But those are tough stories to sell television on. I'm just being honest. Yes, sir.
If the Democrats were to win the presidency, as well as continue control of the Senate and the House, what do you see as the core of the and the focus of a Democrat administration during the ensuing 4 years?
Well, it depends on who's the Democratic president. Because I've looked at these two guys, Clinton and Obama. I think if Obama's president, it will be a very international presidency. He will go on a world tour. He'll be very popular around the world. And he'll be a very internationally focused president. I mean, the irony here, right, we're discussing who's got the more experience. I mean, if Obama becomes president, he will be completely... First of all, I do think the world will just be, what? America actually elected a black man with a Muslim name? You know, so I mean, like, jaws will drop all over the world saying, wow. And, I mean, there will be this sort of honeymoon for America that you haven't seen around the world. I mean, suddenly the American passport will be cool again, right? You know, no more Canadian maple leaves when you're trying to travel around the world. No, I'm Canadian, really, you know. I got a friend who travels, and he's a hardcore liberal Democrat, but he just is one of these people. He just refuses. He hates it when foreigners attack the president, you know, and he just sits there and but he goes, God, I'm getting exhausted from having this argument. You know, it's funny. No, I think that there will be, I do think it depends on who is the president. I think if Clinton's president, I think it's going to be sort of, finally, you will see what happens in Clinton's second term, right? Clinton never had a second term. He had 1 year of his second term and then Monica, right? And then it just sort of nothing. And then, you know, it seemed like nothing happened. One of my favorite history books in college was a book about the 1970s, and the whole thing was it seemed like nothing happened. Because when you look back on it, you're like, God, it all seemed so important then, and you realize it wasn't, right? That's the way that whole Clinton episode felt. It was so important, and yet it seems silly now, post 9/11. So I do think you'll finally see the second, and I have a feeling, you know, Hillary Clinton will be a very domestic president. I feel like it'll be like a mayor. You know, she'll be like the way Clinton was, and it'll be school uniforms and the incremental policy initiatives. And, you know, look, we see, you know, Bill Clinton came in with a Democratic Congress in 1992, and what did he get done? You know, he got NAFTA passed, right, which arguably messed up the Democratic coalition for the next 10 years because it divided the Democratic Party against itself with labor and the coastal Democrats having these fights. So... you know, I think it depends on who's president. It depends what kind of coattails. You know, I talked to some Republican strategists who think that Obama has a ceiling of 55% national popular vote, and Clinton has a ceiling of 52. Well, the difference between 52 and 55 is the difference between, and a 10-point victory and a 4-point victory, is the difference between winning two Senate seats and getting five, winning three more House seats for the Democrats and winning 20 more House seats. You know, and if a president comes in with that kind of mandate, remember Ronald Reagan winning 12 Senate seats in 1980, it was a real mandate. And he suddenly had all these, you know, even though he didn't have control of the House, he did have control of the Senate, and these House Democrats had to work with him because there was a perception of a mandate. What kind of mandate will they have? You know, that hurt Bill Clinton a little bit. He didn't have a mandate when he got elected. It wasn't a perceived mandate, and so he couldn't... He couldn't have the sway over congressional Democrats because every one of them said, "Well, geez, if I had the guts to run, I'd have been president," you know, rather than this yokel from Arkansas. So he had no respect on the Hill. So I think it'll depend on. There's so many things. The size of the victory. I'll say this: if the Democrats don't pass a huge health care bill of some sort, with control of the presidency and control of Congress, which they're likely to have, and if these polls hold, the Democrats likely to, if they can't figure out some sort of long-term health care fix, they'll pay for it for a long time to come. And they'll have to do that in the first 2 years, and that first midterm election will be a referendum on that. That's what I have this feeling, and not as much about Iraq, because you feel like Iraq's going to be on a path, whether that the presidency will have to deal with, will be already on that path going into it.
Do you think there's any likelihood that Mayor Bloomberg will enter the race as an independent? And if so, what would be the consequences on the other candidates and races?
I've had a couple theories on Bloomberg. One is I think the guy's auditioning to be vice president. And people say, that's crazy. He's a corporate executive, made his own money, self-made man. Who wants to be number two? Well, if you get Dick Cheney's job description, I think any corporate CEO would love to be number two. I think this guy would love to be Obama's VP. Constitutionally, he couldn't be Clinton's VP, so we can't talk about that. I guess he technically could, but it would mess up the Electoral College. But I think that's... Look, Bloomberg will only run if at least one... I think, frankly, if both... If Clinton and Giuliani are the nominees, there's no way this country wants a third. I was raised to hate New York, you know, hate New York sports teams. You know, my father grew up in Iowa. You know, New York with the city slickers, smarties, smarty pants people that they all think they're better than me, you know. I just can't imagine we're going to choose between three New Yorkers. You know, my favorite, remember about 4 or 5 years ago, there used to be an advertisement for Pace Picante sauce, right? And the whole thing was they'd look at the competition and they'd say, this thing was made in New York City, you know, and it was sort of like mocking it. You know, you can't get good salsa in New York City, you know, so... I do hate the Yankees still. But I also hate the Red Sox. Don't shove the Red Sox and Yankees down my throat every night. So I just don't think there's room for three New Yorkers. So he's got that problem. And then the other, you know, is ideologically, you know, he needs sort of a polarized environment for him to wedge through the middle. Okay, so I guess on that front, if it were Edwards and Thompson, okay, there's room for Bloomberg, but what's the likelihood of that? You know, for Edwards or Romney, maybe there's room for Bloomberg. I think there's no room for him if it's Obama. Obama's message is this idea that somehow he's going to bring people together and compromise and work with both parties. So, and even Clinton's rhetoric, her new stump speech talks about the same thing. So I think he's having an influence on the process already in sort of an odd way, sort of the way Arnold is out in California by, you know, saying, hey, figure out the middle a little bit. Even Romney talks about this. Hey, I had to work with Democrats in Massachusetts. I mean, sort of, I do think rhetorically he's already had his influence. But as far as political, I mean, I think that if he's on a national ticket, I think he will be Obama's running mate. And that's the only way he's on a national ticket. But that's a prediction that I hope you don't file away. Anyway, yes, sir.
Two questions, please. Do you think that Al Gore is history as a political candidate? And who do you see as some potential vice presidential nominees?
I'll say with Gore, the Nobel Peace Prize voting, I think, ends at the end of this month, and then it gets announced in October. I think we're due for our new Gore boomlet in about 6 weeks. If he wins a Nobel Prize, can you imagine an Oscar, Nobel Prize? Why not file for the New Hampshire primary, right? You know, I've always thought that Gore's... the Gore's calculation in this and all this, if you read his book, I don't know if any of you have, that sounded like a guy who believes the two-party system is broken. You know, everybody talks about Bloomberg as an independent candidate. I've had this idea that maybe it's going to be Gore Bloomberg, and maybe they'll do this interesting, bizarre, way of going outside the system, right? And if Clinton and Giuliani, you could see Gore saying, come around that. I don't think he wants to go through the primary process, per se. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But it was sort of reading between the lines. You know, the other day in Vanity Fair, Tipper Gore apparently finally said, hey, if he wants to do this, I'll support him if he wants to run. So the door is open. I think if Obama doesn't catch fire by this November timeline that I outlined for you guys, and it's mid-November and Clinton looks like the sure nominee, but you can tell people are lukewarm about it, I think Gore would be tempted. Will he end up doing it? Does he have the self-esteem to have another Clinton deny him the White House? I mean, I believe he goes to bed muttering when he thinks about the 2000 election, not about Pat Buchanan and the butterfly ballot, but about Bill Clinton and Monica. Because I think at the end of the day, if you remember that election, George Bush's only message was what? I'm not going to change anything except restore honor and integrity in the White House. Was he running against Al Gore or Bill Clinton? And I think to this day, Al Gore believes that Bill Clinton cost him that presidency, not butterfly ballots, not using Bill Clinton, but that. So the idea that another Clinton could deny him the White, you know, it's sort of like, you know, he gained weight the last time he went through this, right? Imagine, you know, vice presidential runmates, the fun, you know, a year ago I said that anybody with the first name of General would be Hillary Clinton's most likely running mate, you know, General Clark, General Hugh Shelton was always one that I threw out there. I do think some sort of charismatic, lacking white guy from the Midwest, right, or from the Middle South. So, you know, that was Mark Warner, Evan Bayh, Tom Vilsack. There's sort of a number of those. I don't think it'll be Obama. I think there's no way it's Obama. I do think she personally doesn't like him. I think there is some sort of issue there between the two of them. But I also think that there will be the risky side of her will say, you know, no, we got to have a white male on the ticket. You can't try not to do this without a white male. I think Mark Warner will be, my dark horse has been Chuck Hagel, as sort of a way of, you could see how she might say, you know what, this is how I'm going to prove that I'm not going to be polarizing. I can pick a Republican. You know, I joked a year ago, I said, you know, Clinton Hagel versus McCain Lieberman, right? Except now I do think Lieberman will be on the Republican shortlist. Particularly, I think right now, if I had to bet, and if it were Giuliani, I would bet Giuliani McCain as the ticket. I've had this vision that McCain will endorse Giuliani the night before the New Hampshire primary as a way to sort of get Giuliani the nomination. He can't stand Romney personally. If it's Romney's the nominee, I think he will make a hard run at Jeb. I think he will make a big run at maybe some sort of Southerner. I think that Romney will feel like he has to have a Southern conservative. Even Giuliani, I think Mike Huckabee will be somebody that's floated. He has performed well enough. On the Democratic side, by the way, the guy 6 months ago, I think people would have said, Bill Richardson will be the running mate. Now, no way. This guy has melted in the spotlight. I think he's lost out on that. So it'll be fun, that parlor game. And we'll have the longest general election in history, 5 months between the conventions and the end of the nominating process. So 5 months of veep stakes. That's just what the world needs. Jim Webb, he'll be on it. And talk about a guy who's been married 3 times. Normally, a guy like him wouldn't vet. This is different. Clinton Webb wouldn't surprise me at all. The net roots would go nuts over it. They would love it.
Chuck, we have time for one last question.
Okay.
Do you think that maybe Obama's holding back what he stands for or believes because he's being careful politically?
Mm-hmm. I completely think that there have been two different thought processes on how strategically Clinton and Giuliani made the calculation that said, you know what, this campaign is starting now. We better just go all in and keep going and fight. And Obama and a Fred Thompson even said, you know what, people still won't pay attention until Labor Day. And I do think that that's what Obama's waiting for. He's been waiting for Labor Day. Now, that said, I do think he's shortened the window. But I think the Clintons made a mistake. If they made one mistake so far, it's been insisting that they're the front runner and insisting that they have this big lead. Because the polls always close. And the thing is, the more important you claim that the polls are now, the more it'll look like Obama's got momentum if it's closing. Rather, I mean, the Bush people were knew how to manage polling expectations better than anybody. They would sit there, and the day before polls, that they knew that a big event was happening, well, hey, you know what, Kerry will get a bump out of the first debate. It always happens when a challenger and incumbent. So they completely sort of explained away a bump, you know, and then they said, you know, President Bush will likely be ahead by this. You know, they would always be explaining away movements in the polls in a negative so that they could pleasantly surprise expectations. The Clinton folks have not managed these expectations very well as far as the national polls. They have tried to use these national polls to prove they're ahead. You know, no, we're not winning. We're winning big. You know, it's like you never, you know, they complain to me saying we don't call them the front runner enough. I think they believe, and there's this theory, they believe that if Obama ever catches up, they'll never catch him. You know, that he's, I'll use a stock car metaphor since I saw you had a stock car book. She's in a car that can go 150 miles an hour, and she's been going 150 miles an hour. Obama's in a car that eventually could go 220 miles an hour, but right now he's sort of meandering around at 70 or 80, still trying to figure out how to get into third gear, and eventually he might figure it out, and if he ever does, he will fly past her, and they'll never be able to catch him. And I think that's how the Clinton folks are operating. Don't let him out of the gate, because if he ever gets ahead, we'll never. Then everybody will start believing, and he's a movement candidate. Movement candidates are hard to stop once they ever get going. You know, they only can stop themselves, as Howard Dean proved. But you can't. It's hard to assist the stopping on your own. Thank you very much.